Good morning. It's the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. And on the second Monday of every month, we bring in a tech expert to answer all of your tech questions, such as, what should I do if my electronics become waterlogged? Quick story about the first Monday of this month, last Monday, which was our first day back from the holidays on the Larry Mueller Show. A member of our team who shall remain nameless packed all their papers, lunch, water bottle, and WPR-issued MacBook Air laptop computer into their backpack and made their way to work. Somewhere along the way, their water bottle lid popped off, soaking their papers, lunch, and WPR-issued MacBook Air. They could see water sloshing around inside their computer screen. A panicked search on their cell phone suggested they try to dry it out by turning the laptop upside down in the shape of a tent. When they tried to turn it on, the MacBook Air made short squealing noises like it was in pain. Needless to say, this embarrassed, nameless member of our team now has a new WPR-issued MacBook Air, as well as a new leak-proof water bottle. And with that, with us now is Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. He's here to answer your questions and more at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email anytime, talk at WPR.org. And Jesse, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Glad to be here.
So let's start with waterlogged electronics and what you can do to try to save them. If you spill water or some other liquid like coffee on your laptop computer, how does that affect the inside?
Yeah, so usually with any kind of spill, it's hard to know what's going to happen. It does depend, is the device turned on when the spill happens? Even if it's attempted to be turned on while it's wet, if it wasn't turned on before, any kind of electronics where things, you know, energy is actively flowing in the system, and water, you know, they don't mix. So it could cause a lot of different components to break. And usually when there's any kind of spill, it's pretty risky in terms of, you know, whether this device is going to work again in the future. It's really hard to know, but spills, electricity and water do not mix very well. And so it's always a challenge.
Would this nameless member of the Larry Mueller team been more fortunate had it been a cell phone as opposed to a laptop?
Actually, it's very likely, yes. So newer cell phones tend to at least have some better protections if they are in either a moist environment or potentially even submerged. So a lot of new cell phones, you do get some protections. You might also have that from a cell phone case itself. But just due to the nature of cell phones, a lot of manufacturers have made cell phones a little bit more what they call water resistant, not waterproof. So it's not that any water will not affect it, but some moisture being even submerged in a small amount of water will not damage the device, whether it's turned on or turned off. So a cell phone, you're probably a little bit safer. Most laptops are generally not going to survive being turned on and submerged in water. That being said, there are manufacturers that create electronics that really are meant to be underwater. So depending on what you're looking for, you could potentially find that. That being said, it's also going to be more expensive. So you're going to be paying for that premium device that might be able to hold up better with water or just other environmental challenges, whether that's cold, heat, anything else. So you can find it, but it's usually a very specialized market, and usually you're going to pay a little bit more for that.
Sadly, MacBook Airs do not appear to be one of those devices. But what about the idea of turning it upside down in the shape of a tent and see if you can get some of the water out that way? Would that potentially have worked had it not been so waterlogged, or was that likely a lost cause from the outset?
You know, you never know until you try. I've seen a variety of devices damaged, not just spilled on, you know, thrown into a pool, run over by a vehicle. Things do happen. And sometimes you'd actually be surprised with the devices that remain functional. Usually with anything that's wet, the biggest item is to try to let it dry. Try not to touch it. I would, you know, any chance where the water can move around is one of those times where, you know, that that motion can connect, you know, a circuit that might be energized that creates a different issue. So anything you can do to dry it up and not turn the device on is going to be helpful. Usually for most devices, one of the recommendations is going to be, unplug the battery and then allow it to dry for a certain period of time. And then, once you're relatively certain it's dry, you can try to turn it on, or you could even try other mechanisms to try to get data off. In the end, it's challenging these days because a lot of the laptops you get, you can't take the battery out.
Right.
So you're kind of guessing in terms of, is it safe enough to try to turn on? Because if there's still a little bit of water and you try to turn it on, that could be the moment. Maybe it wasn't broken before, right? It was just wet. But the time you hit that power, maybe that's going to be the moment that, you know, the wrong thing happens and the device damages itself and renders itself unusable.
Try to dry it out before you even give it a chance of trying to turn it back on. Sounds like a good plan. Yep. Jesse, I had always heard that where one of the other, maybe it's a good rule of thumb or maybe it's just a myth, is to keep a bag of uncooked rice around. And if you perchance your electronic got wet, you could drop it in a bag of rice and that would help dry it out.
Yeah, usually anything that can help to soak in moisture is going to be useful. Another thing people recommend outside of rice is going to be what they call desiccant. So those little packets you get in a lot of electronics, they really are there to help keep things dry. So you'll see that in a lot of shipped electronics. You can actually buy those in bulk as well. And so you could try to put a device in any kind of area that will try to extract the moisture and put it somewhere else. Anything you can use could be helpful. Doesn't mean it's going to work, but it gives you at least a chance to try to dry things out to see if you can power that device back on.
You mentioned safety before, Jesse, about the safety of the computers, but what about my safety? Are there risks of shock when you're using electronics that have been damaged by water?
There's a possibility. It also depends on the device in terms of how much power is going to be output by the device. Usually with most of the laptops, that's at least not a concern I've had. That being said, if you have a certain device with a large amount of power, that could always be a risk. But most of the consumer laptops, cell phones are usually not going to be that much of a challenge. I wouldn't be at least as concerned. It's always something to think about in terms of what am I touching? Am I grounded? Where can electricity flow if it comes from one hand to another. So for anyone who's taken apart laptops or desktops and has needed to work with some of those components, being grounded, making sure you're working with those devices in a responsible way will help minimize any of those risks. But usually for the laptops, I haven't been concerned with the amount of power and whether I'm going to get a shock.
But anything that would be plugged into an electrical outlet that might be wet would be another story, whether it's your tech or anything else.
Most definitely.
Yeah. What about temperature? When we talk about some of these server farms and data centers that are being proposed, I know it is important to keep them cool. But in the winter weather like these, can there be such a thing as too cool for our electronics?
Any kind of extremes can cause issues, usually not too cool. I mean, if you're in a house, sometimes I kind of joke, if I have enough computers running, maybe I don't have to worry about turning on the heat. I think sometimes the cold can actually help the devices run a little bit better. But just like anything, if you get it too cold, things are going to be extremely difficult for the device. So there is going to be usually a threshold in terms of what's too cold and what's too hot. But if you do have a computer, it's going to react much better to colder weather than it is to much hotter weather. Because in the end, you are trying to really cool it down because it's generating its own heat. So if you're able to give it an environment that's already cooler, that might help it. But it does depend on all of the other electronics that are in your devices. One of the things to keep in mind, most of our newer electronics, there's not a whole lot of moving parts. Things are what we consider like solid state. So they're not moving. We don't have hard drives that are like spinning and being read. It's not always the case. But when you do have extreme temperature differences, different materials can contract and expand. And so that could be another issue where if you have a lot of temperature changes in short periods of time, that could cause other issues. But generally, you know, colder is nice. I think my computers like it a little bit cooler. They tend to run a little bit better. And, you know, they don't have to worry about, you know, overheating. I'm usually more worried about overheating than I am things being too cold.
How hot is too hot, Jesse?
Oh, that's a great question. So it always depends on the device. I would say if you're like an ambient temperature, if you're outside in 100 degree weather with a device, high humidity is probably going to be a little bit more risky because once again, that moisture can be a challenge. I think your device is probably going to have a difficult day. You'll notice it too if you have a cell phone, since we're lucky enough to have devices that have a lot of these mechanisms built into them. If you have your cell phone, let's say you put it on your dash in your car and you're driving around and it's a sunny day, you might look back at your phone to say, to see a message, it's been too hot. I'm going to stop functioning for you for a little bit and turn off. And sometimes you'll get that warning. Sometimes it'll actually turn off itself. So the nice thing is the devices can try to keep up and do what's necessary to save themselves. But being in the direct sun, anything that can make things hotter can be challenging.
Jesse LeGrue, our guest, he's the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, answering all our tech questions today at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Jesse, I am also curious about how to best clean my electronics, because when it comes to things like computer screens or my cell phone screen, you're not supposed to use any sort of Windex or anything like that on them. So what can you do to keep those screens clean?
Most people will just recommend microfiber cloths. Okay. You can get those in a variety of places. They're sold all over the place. And you can use that to basically just wipe clean any device. If you do, you could always use a little bit of water just to get any kind of smudges off. But yeah, they do recommend don't use like Windex or other thing, especially with the difference of screens. So a lot of screens really quite some time ago, so if you had an old what they call cathode ray tube or CRT display, right? It was a big TV looking thing. Right?
I used Windex on those back in the day.
Yeah, but they were glass. They were also a little bit different. And then when we started seeing more of these LCDs, they were not glass, right? They were plastic or some other kind of plastic components. And a lot of those materials really didn't work well together. Now, for some of the devices that might be using glass screens again, there might be more flexibility. That being said, the recommendation is still use a microfiber cloth. Wet it if you need to a little bit, wet the cloth and then, wipe as you need to on the screen. Most of the screens that I have these days, I could use a microfiber cloth. Most of the times if I have a cell phone, I can actually just kind of rub it on my shirt. It gets clean enough. So if you also have screen covers or screen protectors, that could help. It might make it a little bit easier to clean or protect it from scratches as well. So you have a few options. And if you do have different protectors, it might open up other options to clean it. But really, a microfiber cloth is all you should need.
That keeps it simple. When it comes to cleaning the actual electronics, do you get into your desktop computers? Do you use compressed air cannons or anything like that, Jesse?
Yes. Yeah. And actually, that can be kind of terrifying. So if you have a keyboard, especially the ones we get today might be a little bit more, compressed in terms of what can get in and underneath the keys. But I remember with larger keyboards, you can actually pop off the keys, which if you do have a larger keyboard where you can do that, a lot of people do recommend doing it. You can pop off the keys. You can let the keys soak because they're just plastic in most cases to get any kind of gunk off. And then you can actually clean underneath, which could be through like compressed air or something else. Some other keyboards might be a little bit, more challenging. You really can't take off the keys. Compressed air is great. Once again, make sure your electronics are turned off before doing it to get anything out. For people who do have desktops, it might be nice to open the case and actually spray out anything that's in there. I've seen a variety of devices that have had, spider webs, just dust,
mouse nests.
You'd be surprised. So a lot of things can get in there, but you'll also see, depending on the household too. So, I grew up in a smoking household. You will see different artifacts and things inside that case than you otherwise will. And so being able to spray it out is really handy. Having a compressor where you can actually spray it yourself is really handy. Otherwise, you can get those cans of compressed air. Just make sure you kind of keep it vertical when you're spraying it. But those will help get, you know, the dust out. When you get the dust out, that helps the fans run. When the fans are running, it helps the airflow. The airflow helps the cooling. So in the end, you're really trying to make sure, one, you know, maybe it's less gross, but two, especially if it's a device where you have fans and it's trying to cool itself down, getting any of the, like, the gook out of those areas will help your device cool down a little bit better, which actually might improve performance.
And this might be something you would be able to do on your own with a compressed air can, or is this something you would take to a repair shop if you had questions about it?
You could do either. When I was assisting with computer repair, we actually did have a compressor in a closet. And so if somebody did bring it in, or we just noticed, hey, this is a little dirty, let's clean this out, bring it to the room, open it up, spray out anything you could, and, you know, go about your day. So I think you can bring it in somewhere. They might have some similar setup, or they might just recommend, hey, here's a can of air, go ahead and open your case. I think the biggest item people would be concerned about is, you know, if I blow on something inside my case too hard, could something break? And I guess potentially, yes, I've never had that issue. Okay. And a lot of the components we use today are a little bit more resilient. They're also a little bit cleaner. We don't usually see a whole lot of cable messes inside of a device where things are kind of rattling around as much. So usually, you know, things are safe to, you know, blow it and get everything out without damaging it. That being said, you can always just, you know, move your hand further and further away from the case, right? The closer you are, the more of that force is coming directly to the device. So start going a little bit further away and get closer to just make sure you can get out any of that dust.
And maybe give your device a little bit extra life. Jesse LeGrew, our tech expert today for our Tech Expert Monday, answering your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Coming up at noon today, we'll take a look at fire safety in the home and uncover the history of the mafia in Milwaukee. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today on The Larry Mueller Show, and our guest this hour is Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, answering your questions about your electronics, whether they're new from gifts this holiday season or whether you'd like to keep them going a little bit longer and as long as possible. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. And Jesse mentioned taking perhaps your electronics into a repair shop. And one of the thoughts I always have is what kind of security considerations should I have in mind before I hand off my device to somebody else?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's a few things I usually think about when I'd want to give my device to anyone else. One, you know, is the device going to come back in working order, right? When I get it back, could something break? So making sure you have a backup if you can. Usually you're going into a repair area just because something's broken, but, you know, if things work enough where you can do backups, making sure you have a good backup to your data, I think that's important. You might be going to the repair area to actually have a backup done because you can't do it yourself. But make sure you have backups. And if you do have sensitive information that you might be concerned about, you might want to consider removing it. Now, usually you're going to an area for repair that you'd like to consider a trusted agent, right? They are someone you are trusting with your electronics and that are not going to be doing anything you know, malicious with your device or with your data. And so that's just a consideration I would put out there is if you're not quite sure, you know, in the end, you never quite know on the other end what's going to happen. So make a backup, remove sensitive information if you're concerned. Know really what state your device is in before you, you know, give it away. Kind of like a lot of the rules you think about when a rental car. Know what things and dents are there. Know what the fuel tank is. So when you get it back, it should be, you know, ideally in the same condition, if not better, because you're getting it repaired. So just know what you're handing it in. So when you get it back, it's what you intend. But I would really think about the things just like you would any kind of software or email provider you're using. In the end, the device, the data might be somewhere else. How much do you really trust the other end? And so just take that into account. Think about what works for you, I guess, for like your risk profile. Think about it before you drop it off, not after, because if something bad does happen, you don't have a whole lot to do after the fact.
I have a good email here from Nancy and Nina, who says, the end of Nancy's iPhone charging cord evidently got wet on the floor of the car after a snowstorm, which you could imagine would happen in Wisconsin. But plugging it into her phone results in a loud audio warning and a message that moisture was detected. She's waited 4 days now and has been using a wireless charger, yet no matter what charge cord Nancy now uses to attempt to charge her phone, she continues to get the warning. Is there anything she can do, or has she ruined the charger port to her phone, Jesse?
It sounds like since the alert's still happening, it's probably on the phone itself. So maybe there's a little bit of moisture is just still resident in the device that's causing that alert. A couple of things you can do is actually very similar to even if you had something like submerged in water. You could put it in rice. You could put it in a little box with a few packs of desiccant. You know, once again, those little weird plastic packages you hear that rattle around in your electronics, those are meant to suck away moisture. So trying to do that might assist with it. Otherwise, you could also, depending on where you received your phone, you might be able to go into a store and they could offer a recommendation or try something out for you. Normally, it sounds like you've tried a different cord, you've tried a different charger. If you've tried all those things and you're still getting the same message, it does make me think it's probably the phone itself. So I would try to do what I could to try to remove that moisture. And then if that doesn't work, you might want to consider going into a store to see if there's something else that might be done. I don't think in this case a software update or anything is going to fix it. So I think it's really just trying to make sure things are as dry as possible. Try to use a different charger, you know, a different plug and a different cable just to see if you do get a different behavior. I have had, at least in my Android phone, that pop up every, you know, so often if there is a little bit more moisture. Usually over time that message will go away. But if you are still getting it with different cables, it's hopefully you can get it dried out from your phone and it might just be, you know, giving it a little bit more time. Otherwise, yeah, you might want to go to a store.
The bizarre part to me is how it was the charging cord that got wet on the floor, but yet it was the phone that now seems to have the issue with moisture.
Yeah. And it might be that, and you know, depending on how much the end got wet, you know, if it's sitting on the floor and then that wet end, you're literally plugging into your phone, you're kind of transferring the moisture from the plug into the phone. And that's where you might be getting that message. The nice thing is, once again, our phones are in devices are a little bit more resilient. So they're like, ooh, I'm going to find ways to detect moisture and, you know, limit the risk of any device issues. And so they have different sensors that will actually detect moisture and be able to do different things based upon where that moisture is. They also have those inside devices just to see if there was spill damage. But hopefully it's just maybe the moisture is so far up into the phone, it's just taking longer because you don't have as much airflow in order to get the moisture out. So it might just be helping it out a little bit and waiting a little bit longer to try to physical plug again.
Kathy from Oconomowoc emailed us. Her new left AirPod fell into the dishwater while she was doing dishes, and she did put it in a container of desiccants, and it does still work, but the battery doesn't last as long as the right AirPod. So is there anything Kathy can do to build up the battery on the left one, or is it a lost cause?
There's probably nothing you can actually do in order to get the battery to charge more. I don't know if there's like a reset process to try to recondition it. I would just keep on using it over the next, you know, few weeks and see if it changes, because maybe there is still a little bit more moisture. Maybe there's something else not allowing it to charge as fully. And so maybe over time it'll kind of repair itself. But I don't think there's anything actively you can really do to fix it if it doesn't really maintain that charge. You might not have a whole lot of options outside of replacing it.
Sorry, Kathy. Our producer, Clara Neipert, has a WPR issued Bluetooth headset that's about 4 or 5 years old now. I believe it's what she's using to screen calls with today. That is, when it works, because it's having trouble pairing with her new laptop. How can you tell when your headset becomes obsolete or if you're doing something wrong in the Bluetooth pairing process, Jesse?
That's a really good question. One of the challenges I run into is I use a lot of different devices. And so sometimes Bluetooth, it'll usually try to pair with the last device you use, which if you use multiple devices, it gets kind of weird because it pairs with the wrong device and you have to unpair it, disconnect it, repair it, or reconnect it with a new device. That's usually the first thing I take a look at when I have anything Bluetooth is what else is it trying to connect with? And can I simplify my life by disconnecting it or unpairing it with those other devices? Outside of that, if you're using the same device over and over, and it's really just between, let's say, your one laptop and your one set of headphones, it could be the laptop or the other device, because in this case, Bluetooth has to work on both ends. Mm-hmm. So it could be the device, not the headphones. And so try it with a different device, see if the behavior is better, because it could be a software issue as well. So it may not be the headphones, it could be software, it could be the Bluetooth module actually on the laptop or the other device you're pairing it with. So it goes now into the troubleshooting process of, is it the headphones or is it something else? And so try a different device, see if the behavior is better. If the behavior is better with a different device, you might want to take a look specifically at that other device your headphones are having an issue with, because it could be a software update or potentially another hardware issue that that device is having.
Makes me think of the list of Bluetooth devices in my car, which is a running list of all my old and now dead cell phones. That they're still there, even though the phones have long disappeared. I want to pivot now to some of the spyware that we're hearing about, because last month there were hundreds of people who received an alert on their cell phones warning that their device had been targeted by spyware. And it was just a few days later that both Apple and Google fixed these security holes that experts believed were being used to put malware on personal devices. How are we to, and some of these stories include what are now zero click spyware and malware, which means there is nothing you have to do wrong in order for them to get into your electronics. With this new wave of warnings and spyware being installed without us having to do anything, what can we do to protect ourselves, Jesse?
Yeah, there's a few things, and a lot of, I think we heard a lot of this over the last many years, really, with the Pegasus malware, which was a really good example of zero click. You just need to receive a text. You don't even need to interact with it in order for a device to get infected. In a lot of these cases, it's really a lot of significant investment to develop the tools in order to be able to do this. So usually it's targeted at smaller populations, because the more people that get it, the easier actually it is to find and to correct. So the more this spreads, in some ways it might actually get better, because the phone manufacturers and software developers will develop better protections for a lot of these things. That being said, if it doesn't exist, what do you do? The biggest thing, you know, and I'll recommend to everyone, is always update your device. So a lot of updates come out for devices regularly for feature updates, but also fixes for what they call a lot of these like zero-day vulnerabilities, in which you have 0 days to patch it, because, well, it's out there. People are using it. It's a vulnerability that is actively being used to get into people's devices and to get data. So update your device is always going to be good. If you can actually create, which is really challenging, kind of like allow lists for phone numbers that you would accept, that would include phone calls or text messages. If you know you're only getting trusted individuals into your phone, that will hopefully minimize the risk of any of those contacts or external contacts trying to, you know, infect your device with malware or something else. In addition, use your main app stores. So for iPhones, we have the App Store, and we have Google Play for Android devices. If you use that trusted App Store to install software, that being said, some of those software packages, could they be bad? It's possible. And so you also need to kind of think about, what am I installing? But if you are using third-party avenues to install software, that creates additional risk because a lot of the checks that happen through a lot of those providers are not happening either at all or in the same way that they are with those centralized providers. So try to use the trusted processes that are put in place to try to protect you and your devices, and be mindful in terms of what you're interacting with, who you're getting software from, who you're actually getting text messages from. And just like any device, I would say keep out for your device acting weird. And you might wonder, like, what does that mean? What is weird? And I would say it's anything that's not usual that you are anticipating. So lower battery life, if you see pop-up messages that you didn't have before, or just other things on your device that you wouldn't anticipate seeing. And sometimes those can happen from software updates because maybe things move around, colors change. But keep an eye for those things and know, is there something that could have happened recently that would have caused this? Because it's usually those unusual things that people notice, which could be an indicator of some kind of bad software or something just not working in the way it should.
Dang, Jesse, you just made me think of this. The Washington Post app on my cell phone has, and it's the only place it happens, has like a pop-up ad that asks if I want a snooze alert or something. It doesn't look like anything else in the Washington Post app. It doesn't appear to be an ad, and yet there's nothing I can do but click one of the options in this little black box. Only happens with the Washington Post. And so the only move I have to make is to close the Washington Post app to make it go away, because I'm afraid to click on anything because it does not look kosher.
Yeah, and for any of those items too, where you're not sure, well, is this the app? Is it potentially a bad ad, right? Mm-hmm. Something that is coming through a third party, because most of the times in a lot of our apps, on especially mobile phones, they're not all coming through an app. They're coming through a variety of third parties, especially if it's ad driven to, raise revenue for a variety of reasons. In that case, I would even start searching on the internet. Are other people seeing this? Is mm-hmm. this something that's standard? You might also be able to go back to the company that it basically paid for the app to be developed, whether they're doing it themselves or hiring somebody else to do it. Is this normal? Is this what I should be seeing? So some of that might need to be cross-checked with just information available online and what other people are seeing. The more that people actually put it out there and ask the questions, you actually get a little bit more confidence in terms of, well, other people are seeing it just because, and this might be normal. That being said, just because it's usually seen doesn't mean that it's good. And so you still want to question, it seems like everyone else is noticing the same behavior, but really, should it be doing this? And what else can I do in order to get rid of this? In some cases, for some apps, it means paying money. In others, it might mean, not using the app or, using it in a different way.
What's the best thing I can do to find out whether or not my electronics have been infected?
Probably the best outside of, taking a look for unusual behavior is to kind of do a regular check of your device. Look at the apps you have installed. Is there anything unusual? Hmm. Part of this is kind of understanding too what's installed on your phone. A lot of, and people have limited time. They're not going to be like, I'm going to take a look at my phone every month and see what apps are installed and then cross-reference this to my spreadsheet to see if there's anything new or anything that changed. People don't have a lot of time for that, but if you're able to limit what's on your device and understand what's on your device, I think it helps out. That being said, many devices come pre-installed with a variety of software from your cell phone provider or other third parties like your device manufacturer that you may not be able to remove and that you just need to live with. So I'd say keeping kind of a self inventory is extremely helpful, looking up for those unusual behaviors and keeping things updated. Also, a lot of the zero click malware that has been coming around, some of those, and I don't know how exclusive this is, but many of those do not survive a reboot. And so if you just reboot your phone, you might be fine.
And again, those zero clicks are ones that you could install on your electronics through no fault of your own. You wouldn't have to do anything for them to enter into your system. And it's the basically the operating systems that are behind the scenes trying to prevent this. But if it's as simple as a reboot, well, that always seems to be the first thing that a tech expert would tell you to do when there's any trouble whatsoever.
Correct. And this might not work every time, but for a lot of the things that people had seen, especially with Pegasus, they didn't survive on reboot. If they do, which they usually call that persistence, but it remains. It may not be true all the time, but sometimes just rebooting your device, making sure it gets a clean startup. One, it'll allow the software to, a lot of them will do self-checks when it boots back up. But maybe if there is something weird running in the background, hopefully it will exit that and you'll at least start with a little more confidence that things are fresh and clean. It's not a guarantee, but it might help.
Nancy and Nina, we have an update for you. Now, Nancy's iPhone charger got wet, and now Nancy's iPhone says that she can't use that charging port anymore because of moisture that got inside it. Connie emailed to recommend that Nancy use canned air spray, which we've been talking about, the compressed air cans, to spray the charging plug of her phone because it worked for Connie. Well, maybe it'll work for Nancy and Nina, and thank you both for emailing us. Our guest, Jesse LeGrue, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Larry Mueller returns tomorrow, and his guest will be Dr. Zorba Pastor. Join Larry Mueller and Dr. Pastor tomorrow at 11 o'clock. I think they're on at noon. We're going to have patient advocates talking with Larry to start the show tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Right now, I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and it's our Tech Update Monday, answering your tech questions at talk at WPR.org or 800-642-1234, where Jack and Madison standing by. Jack, good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I've got a Samsung phone, and when I try to plug in the power cord just to transfer files to my PC, it really doesn't work that well anymore. I have to jiggle it around, and it's very delicate. I don't know if it's just dirty, if I can clean it, or if it's damaged and needs to be repaired or replaced.
I'll ask Jesse here in a moment, but I've had this experience myself, and I think it ended up being pocket lint that was in the little port in my phone that had jammed in there, and I couldn't get the wire or the cable all the way in. So I had a little a plastic pick or something in there, or a little air cannon, got the pocket lint out, and I was able to reconnect that way. Jesse, what do you think?
Yeah, I think pocket lint is a good thing to take a look for. I also have a Samsung phone, but it's not just Samsung phones. I would try a different cable just to see if a different cable is better, especially the one in my car. It tends to fail after a certain amount of time just because of movement. But pocket lint is actually pretty common. Usually in the past, and I probably shouldn't use something metal, but if you have a really thin paperclip, can kind of get in there and like scoop out the paper, any of the lint. If you have good tweezers, that might help as well. But really anything you can kind of get inside, plastic, I think is going to be a good option if you have something small enough. So you can kind of get in there and just pull anything out. Over the years, I've actually been surprised at how much lint collection there. And if you do have a good amount of collection in there and you start pulling in there, like, wow, that's quite a bit. And all of a sudden everything works great. So you plug in your cable, it sits better. Like you can actually feel the difference when you plug in the cable. So pocket lint, yeah, it's definitely the first thing I would take a look at. But I'd also just try a different cable to see if the other cable works better. Cause sometimes, just the cables fail for a variety of reasons, whether it's, manufacturing defect or just, things moved in the wrong way at one time. And the only best way to fix it is to use a different cable. So those are probably the two main things, that lint probably being the first one to check out.
Jack, thank you for the call. And I have certainly been there with my ports. Don't forget to clean your ports carefully. I also wanted to ask you about, and I'm sure some folks got this for the holidays as a gift, smart vacuum cleaners, smart home devices, and the questions that about these smart devices, where the information they collect goes, and how we can make sure we stay secure as we add these Internet of Everything sort of devices to our homes, Jesse.
Yeah, and so this is, I wish I had an easy answer for this because oddly enough, so, and, you know, I experiment with a variety of, you know, home devices that will, you know, simplify life for you, right? You can check in your cell phone, even if you're at, you know, a restaurant or even out of the country. So it gives you a lot of capabilities to like manage things when you're completely remote. That being said, if things can talk to, you know, somewhere in the world, some data center, some centralized service, it means some of that data is leaving your house. And for robot vacuums, that could be your floor layout in terms of what things look like. Depending on the cameras, maybe it could be more information. So I think trying to limit some of the data being either collected centrally is going to be extremely helpful. It may or may not impact the usefulness of the device. So if the device doesn't have the internet, will it create an issue for actually using the device itself? If it does, you might have limited things you can do outside of getting a different vacuum. But if you're able to not connect it to Wi-Fi and keep things localized to just what it's doing in your house, I think that's helpful, especially if you're concerned with any other data it might collect. Usually a robot vacuum, I don't think would have a microphone, but if it does, I think that's a concern a lot of people have had with a variety of home assistants.
Well, I think baby monitors and things like that, that families rely on for their own security and safety, things that do have cameras and microphones and speakers, and how secure that information is and how susceptible they would be to hackers.
Right. And so anything you connect to the internet could have an issue with potentially, being accessed remotely, not to mention just that data being stored somewhere else. Even then, if you do have a provider for, let's say it's another example is a doorbell, right? You know, it's taking a look at the outside. Granted, it's public, but you might have audio, you might have video. Where is that data being stored? Even if you trust the company, it doesn't mean they might not have some kind of security intrusion, which means somebody else can get access to the data. So even if you trust everyone, you know, things happen. And so that data can go out there. So when, you know, picking all these options, it's really a choice. How sensitive do I feel the data is that you're collecting? Who's storing it? And am I comfortable with that?
Yeah,
and
you said, even if I trust the company, if I'm buying this device, why would I be suspect of the company that's providing it?
Right. And, you know, you might fully trust the company, but we've seen a lot of instances too where, you know, I generally trust the organizations that I work with, but I also know, you know, you're one click away from having a bad security day and somebody else having access to your information. Just like, you know, we think about the options and, you know, once again, these are not happening all the time, but they're constant risks out there. You have somebody that's working at the company that you trust. That individual, that engineer has a cell phone. They just had a zero-click text on their phone that infected their device, which they use to manage some of the you know, development repositories they use to manage the product that you have in your home. And so you start thinking about these little threads of how can somebody get into something. And there's a lot of ways. It doesn't mean being terrified of the world, but that there are, you know, reasons to consider not hosting information in different areas, or at least considering how risky is it if this data got out. And I think I'd recommend anyone using a lot of these services to really think about it, because I think it's likely going to happen, maybe, and I hope it's never with really sensitive information. But if this got compromised and, you know, landed on the front page of the paper, how concerned am I? Am I concerned about the general floor layout of my house being out there on the public? Probably not too much. And so for me, that would be reasonable, as long as I know, you know, there's no microphones, there's no other cameras outside of, you know, options to understand where there might be obstacles. And so doing a cost benefit on like that risk of that data is really helpful, because it at least lets you choose, yeah, I'm okay if that got compromised. It's totally fine with me. It's not of a big risk. So think about that with just about every product.
Talking about compromise, Keith emailed us. He says about a month ago, he began to hear from a bunch of people who had received an email from one of his Gmail accounts ostensibly sharing a folder, but Keith did not send that email, and that email address has a long, complicated password that probably could not have been hacked. Keith didn't share login info with anyone. The message went to some people he'd never emailed before, but may have been included in a message that was forwarded by another person, a third party. He has not talked to anyone who opened the folder or heard about any consequences if this happened. What if this happened to you, Jesse?
Well, there's a couple of things I'd take a look at. One, so if I thought it was my email account, I'd log in. Usually Google and a lot of other services will give you an option to see where you've logged in from. And so you can actually see, did someone access my account outside of me? So that's one thing I'd probably take a look into myself is, who else might have accessed my account? Was it really compromised? Because it might not have been. It could just be either like a falsified sender, or somebody sent this email in a different way. So it could just be a phishing email that had nothing to do with his account, but his account seemed to be part of it. Mm-hmm. At least it looked that way. Outside of that, I would ask some of the people who received the email, hey, can I get a copy of that? Because I'd be curious, what does it look like? Do I see it in my sent folder? Is the link that it's going to? Because it's very likely that link is not actually a shared folder that might expose data. It could be a phishing link that could either install malware, ask for data collections, or other pieces. So it might be a phishing email that could be something people just want to ignore. But I try to understand, did it really come from my account? Does anyone else access it? And do I need to protect it? Or did somebody just get a phishing email that...
Well, that seems to be likely, Jesse, because as Keith points out, the message went to some people he had never emailed before, but people who had may have been included in a message that was forwarded by another person. That other person could have been hacked or could have had access to their email accounts, found all the email addresses, and posed as them online?
Yep.
Interesting. And one more email before we're done here. Peter from Eden emailed us. He has an older router, a Netgear, and received a message from the manufacturer that he needs to upgrade his router for security and performance purposes. Peter wants to know, how necessary is this? Are they just trying to upsell Peter a new device?
So it could be serious. It could be a little bit of both. Netgear and a lot of other devices on the internet they're just trying to get attacked all day long by bots. So if you do have an out-of-date device, I do recommend, if you can't get software updates, you should consider replacing it. In addition, if you do have access to your router, one of the things that I would look for on any device is something they call UPnP, or Universal Plug and Play. Make sure you have that turned off. That will help at least with some of the device exposure and potentially exposure of any other services you might have on your home internet. But it is very likely your device is like end of life. You're not getting software updates, and you may need to upgrade in order to get the benefit. If you search for the model of your device, you'll likely get more information. It may also be in the email you receive from the manufacturer. But I do recommend try to have something that's up to date, especially if you have any publicly facing services you might be running from home that could impact your environment. So
I think my router had default UPP turned on. Can you go over that again briefly, Jesse?
Yeah, it's something called Universal Plug and Play. It's really something meant to allow you to access different services remotely. So it could be a NAS, network attached storage, or some other device. They might take advantage of it. The downside with having Universal Plug and Play, which is meant to make things easier for you, it might try to put something out on the internet you actually really don't want on the internet, which basically allows somebody to try to attack it remotely when otherwise they may not be able to. So if you don't have a service that needs it, or you're not sure, I would say turn it off. If you're like, ooh, this thing broke when I turned this off, it at least gives you something to research a little bit more. But generally, I would turn Universal Plug and Play off unless you have a really specific need.
Hope that helps, Peter, and thank you for the email. Jesse LeGrew, thank you as always to you. It sounds a little bit scary out there, but it also makes us sound like there are steps we can all take to make ourselves safer. So thanks again.
Looking forward to it next time.
Jesse LeGrew is the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. When we continue, we'll speak with a fire inspector with Eau Claire's Fire and Rescue about the things perhaps you can do to prevent the next tragic house fire. Tis the season right now, so how can you keep you and your family safe? That's next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. Larry's back tomorrow. You're listening to WPR News.